Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Stride, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting is found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition for the fourth week of March 2024, we will dive into GQ's Men of the Year issue. We've sampled it here and there over the last few weeks, but today we are jumping into the deep end of the pool with articles on their icon of the year, Fashion's Tom Ford, their tycoon of the year, Kim Kardashian. I know, she's a woman and she's a reality TV star, but she's also whip smart, more serious than you might think, and GQ likes to push boundaries and challenge stereotypes with their Man of the Year issue. And then we will close with their free spirit of the year, rap legend Andre 3000. Before we begin this GQ tour de force of male and female achievement, I should mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and on occasion language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. Icon of the year. He sold his company and has set his sights on a new goal. As he walks away from the fashion world, Tom Ford talks candidly about all of it. The empire he built, the grief he's endured, and what he's planning for his third and final act. Death, Sex, and Money, the Tom Ford Exit Interview by Will Welsh. Isn't one of your first questions like, what the hell are you doing in Palm Beach? Here is Tom Ford, the king of sex, looking still at 62, very much like the king of sex, if not terribly Palm Beachy. He's wearing heavily distressed blue jeans and a blue denim shirt with few enough pearl buttons fastened to reveal an impressively muscular chest gilded in hair, plus black Chelsea boots and a Texas Timex, a gold Rolex Oyster Perpetual watch that he bought on Place Vendôme in Paris during his 10-year reign at Gucci. Ford has agreed to an exit interview, capping his historic 3-decades-long fashion and beauty career, saying he is willing to discuss anything and everything under the condition that I come to Palm Beach, where he is currently living with his 11-year-old son, Jack. Since stepping away from fashion earlier this year, Ford has largely declined interviews until this one. As we talk, I find myself thinking that part of the reason he acquiesced is simply because he's lonely. I'm not used to sitting around talking about myself anymore, Ford says. It feels very bizarre. I have no mate, no partner, no adult in my life. I talk about, you know, Minecraft, YouTube, messy. So just having an adult conversation at all is a bizarre thing for me. In November 2022, Estee Lauder, Ford's partner in his juggernaut fragrance and beauty business going back to its launch in 2005, announced that it had agreed to buy the entirety of his namesake label for a total of $2.8 billion. The deal made him, personally, a billionaire. It also signaled the end of Ford's unprecedented run in the luxury business. Starting with his electric star-making turn at a previously floundering Gucci and continuing with the booming success under his own name, Ford's persona and very visage transcended the insular world of fashion and became culturally synonymous with swagger, sex, and luxury itself. When I ask Ford why he sold his company and, yes, what the hell is he doing in Palm Beach, the answer is the same. Richard's death. Ford and fashion journalist Richard Buckley met in an elevator at a fashion show in 1986. It was love, Ford has said, by the time the elevator hit the ground floor. They were together for 35 years and married for 9 until Buckley's death in September 2021 after complications stemming from an earlier cancer treatment. In the wake of that loss, Ford and Jack moved here full-time into a 1920s mansion acquired in a house swap with a neighbor, a deal that reportedly carried a total value of well over $100 million. As we sit in the living room, Ford's butler, Anthony, brings Ford a Diet Coke and me a glass of sparkling water. Outside, there is an occasional rhythmic thud, which turns out to be Jack, who is running the length of the house, pounding a soccer ball into a pair of nets. This is an unusually quiet moment for Ford. We agree to call it the second intermission in his career, a break before the third act as a full-time filmmaker begins. Ford still delivers heroic doses of all his most recognizable personality traits, the impeccable old-world manners, the grandiloquent bombast, the devastating charm, and the outrageous provocations. But over the course of our time together, he also reveals a new sensitivity and more than a little heartbreak. "Maybe a year ago," Ford tells me, "I had to have knee surgery from tennis, so they had to put me under, and when I went in, they said, 'Who do we contact in case of emergency?' And I literally had no one. So I put my PA." Our interviews begin with a 3-hour session in Ford's living room and continue over dinner in a corner booth at the nearby restaurant Le Bilboquet. Ford picked me up from my hotel in his black Range Rover autobiography with Sirius XM's Studio 54 channel playing. They conclude several weeks later over Zoom. "I've been working on a joke. It goes, 'How do you dress for Palm Beach in September?' And the answer is, 'You shouldn't be in Palm Beach in September.'" It's true. It's a weird ghost town, and even when it's going, it's a suburb of New York. And that's how I think of it. 2 hours and 20 minutes. No jet lag. We're going to London on Wednesday. Jack's coming with me because since Richard died, he's terrified I'm going to die. "Did he express that verbally? 'Dad, I'm scared you're going to die too.'" "Oh yeah," I said. "Look, I can fly, but you could crash." "Yeah, I'm not going to crash." "You don't know that." "Okay, I don't know that. So let's say I go somewhere and a plane crashes. You're still alive. If you're with me, you're dead. Which would you rather be?" And he said, "I'd rather be with you." "Oh my God, so why Palm Beach?" Richard and I lived in London for 22 years, Paris for 10, Milan for 4. But this time we moved back to L.A. from London because he was sick. The house in L.A. was basically Cedar Sinai. And every contemporary memory I have of it is not good. It was a sad house. After Richard died, I was driving back from a screening at CAA that Madonna was having for, like, 4 people. The streets were deserted everywhere. I was so used to Richard being in the seat next to me, and I felt so lonely. I just thought, this is the loneliest place. I have to get out of here. I thought, where can I give Jack the life he's used to? Which is tennis every day, soccer every day, warm weather, swimming pools, a liberal grade school. I have a history with Palm Beach going back to when I was at Gucci. And after shows, I would rent a little place here, just come and do nothing. Lie by the pool, you know? Anne Rice, in one of her vampire books, wrote that every 150 years, vampires had to dig themselves down into the ground in order to come back up eventually and appreciate life again. That it was all just too much, and that's what I feel this is. This is like a reset. I needed that to figure out Act 3. And so, now that you've sold your company, how are you thinking about Act 3? There are several reasons I sold my company. I felt like, after 35 years, I had said everything I could say with fashion. It's important to know when to get off the stage. I loved making the 2 films that I made. That was the most fun I've ever had in my entire life. I'm 62. Hopefully, I'll remain somewhat together until 82. So I want to spend the next 20 years of my life making films. And the clock is ticking. And so it was time to say goodbye to fashion. Fashion is a younger man's game. Designers rarely change the world of fashion at 62. I did it at 35, maybe until 45. And then I shifted into the moment when you become a household name and you make a lot of money. What were the other factors that led you to decide to sell the business? Richard's death, boy, talk about mortality. When someone dies, their eyes are open. You can't close them. It's not like in the movies where they do this and Ford passes his hand over his eyes and they stay closed. They pop open. Wow. I spent 2 hours with him talking to him because I wasn't expecting him to die that particular day. You know, slipping his wedding rings off, taking off his watch, flipping his body over to take his wallet out before they took him away. I felt like I was robbing him. Talk about driving home the idea of a limited time on the planet. It was like, I really want to make movies. Clock's ticking. Let's go back to the beginning of your fashion career. How did you end up working at Perry Ellis? Marc Jacobs hired me. At that time, he was creative director of all Perry Ellis, and I remember being very jealous that he was younger than I was, but somehow he was more successful. And before long, you landed a job at Gucci and moved to Milan, right? I was pragmatic enough to know, even at that time, that if you become famous as a European designer, you are global. If you become famous as an American designer, you are American. You know, Calvin Klein in Europe meant nothing. Marc became a global brand because he went to Vuitton. Had he not gone to Vuitton, the rest of the world wouldn't know who Marc Jacobs was. So I knew that, and I thought, if I'm going to work hard and be a success as a fashion designer, I need to go to Europe. So you're the design director at Gucci at age 30, but Gucci was in disrepair. The task was to reanimate it. In the beginning, did you think of it as a dream job or a stepping stone that got you to Europe? It was a stepping stone. Mauricio Gucci's dream was to make it an Italian Hermès, which it had been in his childhood. It was a good dream and a good idea, but it wasn't fashion. They didn't really make clothes like people think, and they didn't really have big runway shows. So I thought, well, if I learn all of the manufacturers and how everything works in Europe, I'll start my own brand. And then I didn't need to, because once I became creative director, it felt like my own brand. I grafted my personality onto the Gucci brand. I went back and watched your old fashion shows on YouTube, and all I could think is, this collection fucks, you know? So much of the magic of your time there was connected to sex. I would give the models a talk right before the show, and I would say with my microphone, after I'd already had the drinks, when you walk down the runway, everyone in the room should want to fuck you. Everyone. Now, I didn't do that same speech for the last 5 years. I can't say that to models anymore. Everyone should want to fuck you. But I used to always say that, and it was important even in the way they looked, in the way they walked. So let's dig in on the Gucci years. Do you remember where you were when you got the call that Maurizio Gucci had been shot and killed? Yes, absolutely. I was in Florence at our factory. It was early in the morning, 8:30 a.m. Maurizio had an office across the street from my office, and from my window I could see the steps where he was shot, but I wasn't there. I think everyone's first thought was that it was a mafia hit. Ridley Scott didn't put this in the movie, House of Gucci. At one point, Maurizio had to cough up $40 million to InvestCorp. He didn't have the money. No bank was going to loan it to him, and he magically came up with it. You assumed, well, the mafia gave him the money. You're in Italy. Also, those scenes in the Ridley 1997 Scott movie where I come in and meet with Maurizio and I say, I see men in thongs. None of that ever happened. I didn't see men in thongs at first. They came later. House of Gucci was a little condensed. Your first show there was not a hit. It was terrible. After that show, Richard said, you got to find a way to make it sexy. The girls have to want to wear the clothes. The girls don't want to wear those clothes. And that was all he had to say, and it was like, yes. So what was the breakthrough? It was with men's. There was a men's show in Florence. At that time, I was young enough to still actually go out to clubs, and you could feel this 70s revival starting up, so I went deep into that. I took the Gucci loafer for men, and I made it in patent leather car finish, and I used tons of velvet and color and silk shirts open to here, and it worked. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to carry this through for women, and I did, although it was the next show. Fall 1996, for Gucci, that was the closest one to what is still my own permanent taste, the show with the white dresses with the cutouts and the women in tuxedos. It was more understated in a way, but it hit a chord in the room. I could feel it. Back then, people didn't have phones. You had 13 minutes to introduce something that should jar them, and then convince them of it, and then make it so beautiful they would want to cry. After you set the world on fire and your Gucci was the hottest thing going, what was the pressure like? Oh, I was so into it, feeding off of it. To really be successful at women's fashion, you have to live and breathe nothing else. 24 hours a day, there can be nothing else in your life. Once you capture the zeitgeist, like with the run of three shows at Gucci, how do you keep it going? Oh, it's easy. You have to keep a thread of yourself in it. People used to say, how do you make everything so sexy? And why do you make everything so sexy? I don't start out saying we need to make a sexy dress. I look at a dress and I say, I can't see her waist. I want to see that. I can't see her ass. I want to see, where are her tits? We had dinner in LA once, and you said to me, you give the world your taste once. That's it. Well, it's true. To what extent was that 10 years at Gucci your one time at the zeitgeist? That was it. I kept finessing that for the rest of my career. I had a 10-year run, and I think that's all you get. A PR person would tell me not to say that, but that was where I moved the needle culturally. I was in my 30s and early 40s. How many years will Taylor have it? I mean, the Beatles. When you actually go back and look at how long they existed, it was like 7 years, 8 years, nothing. And from there, you were just moving the pieces around the board. I mean, if you get that much time, that's amazing. Well, tell me about a wild moment from the Gucci years. Well, what's the statute of limitations? That's a hard one. When I wanted to show those G-strings, it was hard to get a really good male model. And finally, one of them was like, yes, I'll wear the thong. Well, thank God. At the show, he was about to go down the runway, and I would check everyone, right? I looked down, and it was like Peter Cottontail. So much hair sticking out of his ass crack. I said, give me the trimmers. I bent him over and literally just went zip. And then I said, okay, you can go out. And out he went. One thing I didn't understand until I started researching this piece is what an instrumental role you played in, essentially, creating the modern fashion system, which is dominated by French luxury conglomerates, LVMH and Kering. So, in 1999, Bernard Arnault and LVMH attempted a hostile takeover of Gucci when you and Gucci Group CEO Domenico De Sole were at the height of your powers. It played out in the papers every fucking day back when it was happening. It was in the Financial Times, in the Wall Street Journal. It was everywhere. The LVMH takeover was ultimately thwarted through an alliance you and Domenico formed with Francois Pinault, who had not previously been in the luxury business. He became majority shareholder in Gucci, and that's when the Gucci group really transformed into this multi-brand luxury group, which is now called Kering. We created Kering. There was a name change, but we created Kering. Why build a group? We had $3 billion to invest, courtesy of our deal with Francois, and we needed to grow. So the first acquisition was Saint Laurent, and it was $1 billion. It was done only if I would design it, because at the time, everything I touch worked. Not always the case, but it was definitely the case then. We had to deploy this cash, but my criteria in figuring out who to invest in was, I'm the only creative person here. In case something happens, you can't have a company that big with one creative. Who do I admire? Whoever those people are that I admire and I'm jealous of, we need to get. So I went after Lee McQueen. Can you say more about what you responded to about Alexander McQueen as a designer? I was a commercial fashion designer. That doesn't mean there wasn't an artistic element to what I did, but I was a commercial fashion designer. Lee was an artist who happened to use the medium of clothing and fashion shows to express himself. At that moment in time, current Louis Vuitton artistic director of women's wear, Nicolas Gerchker, was hot, absolutely hot, and he did something totally different than what I did. I wanted him to start his own collection. He didn't want to do that, so we bought Balenciaga. And he was at Balenciaga. Stella McCartney addressed a totally different customer than we did not have. She was onto all of this environmental stuff, way ahead of everybody else, and so that made sense. With Bottega Veneta, I went after Thomas Meyer. He and Richard were best friends back in the 80s, and he had the best taste. In assembling it, you needed brands that didn't compete so that you could have a very well-rounded portfolio and people that I admired. So that's what we did. Does business success get you off the way creative success does? Oh, I am half businessman, half designer. I always was. I have a gift. My greatest gift is you can lay 5 pairs of shoes down in front of me, and the one that I pick will be the commercial one. I have commercial taste. Maybe, hopefully, at a high level. But if you're not making money, you can't do what you want. There's an intuition that comes with the kind of business brain I have. I have a certain feeling about it, and I know that it's the right business decision, even though it makes no sense to someone who's just looking at spreadsheets. You know what's coming next. You feel it. So as you step away from luxury fashion, where do you think it's all headed? I have no idea. That's one reason I'm stepping away. I don't really believe you. You don't have that same intuitive feeling. It's gotten so far away from why I got into the business, which was to make a beautiful garment that made a person stunning and incredible looking when they walked into a room. That was why I became a fashion designer. So this new, what it has become, is something that maybe I understand, but I don't necessarily like. You sent me a text the other day about your successor at Tom Ford, Peter Hawkings, who worked for you for years. You mentioned how displeased you are by some of the things he's been saying as he gets started. I have since calmed down a little bit, but I read in a GQ blog or something where Peter said he was given a blank page to start Tom Ford Menswear. Yes. It really upset me because starting Tom Ford Menswear in 2007 was one of the things I'm probably the most proud of in my entire career. I was used to being at Gucci, and when I wanted something, I just had it made. And all of a sudden, I couldn't. I didn't have any clothes, so I brought in all the clothes from my wardrobe. I had everything made in my size. Luckily, I'm a 48 regular, which is the fitting size, so I fit all the suits on myself. Peter wasn't able to start for a while. He was still John Ray's assistant at Gucci. So those first few years, that collection was built on me. It was enormously personal. I literally sent my sofas out to be copied for the stores. I loaned art from my house to the stores. It was one of the things I'm most proud about because it was the foundation of the company. So I got in touch with him recently. I said, Pete, I don't want to say these things publicly and contradict you, but it wasn't exactly a blank page. I was very worked up about it. I'm a lot less worked up about it now. You know, when you sell your company, you're prepared for anything, and I really am prepared for anything. Whatever direction they go, Peter's blank page starts now. But you know, that's my fashion legacy, the Tom Ford Company, the Tom at Gucci, the Tom at Saint Laurent, that's mine. It's tied up in two neat volumes with a bow. Between Peter Hawking's debut at Tom Ford and Sabato De Sarno's debut at Gucci, all anyone seemed to be talking about at Fashion Week in Milan was the influence of Tom Ford at Gucci. Well, it's very nice, but I didn't give it a lot of thought. Fashion is cyclical. That was, God, 20 years ago. I'm glad that what I did has come back again. Of all the famous men that you dressed over the years, who embodied the Tom Ford man the most? Oh, God, who embodied the Tom Ford man? I mean, me. I built it for myself. Brad Pitt was the very first one to wear the brand, and at the beginning I had an exclusive thing with Brad. I would only dress Brad. Brad only wore me, or he wore me to his big events. At Gucci, we were sending clothes to everybody, and it lost its cachet. So when I launched Tom Ford, I went to Brad, and that was who I dressed. Did you pay him? No, I never paid a single celebrity to wear my clothes or come to a show, ever. Ever, ever, ever. And now everyone does. You mentioned to me that you've been sober for 14 years. When you stopped drinking, did that cut off the drugs too? The alcohol was a gateway to the drugs. And, you know, my son hasn't read any of this stuff yet. He will, and I'll need to talk to him because he shares the same genetic background that I do, which is English-Irish. I think we're predisposed. My father was a heavy drinker, but the alcohol, you know, was a gateway. Cocaine is very popular in the fashion world, and I realized it was a problem when I started doing it in the mornings. So, how are you feeling about selling your company, Tom Ford International? Well, I realized one day I was going to die and that I created something that will live on past me because there is too much money involved. So whether it's 50 years from now or 5 years from now, a lot of stuff that I hate will be generated. People are going to do a lot of shit with it that would make you turn over in your grave. Why not let them do it now? Just do it while you're alive. I mean, do you think Balenciaga or Givenchy, I mean, Hubert de Givenchy would die if he saw, and so would Cristobal Balenciaga. So why not have fun for the rest of my life and do something I find really creatively exciting? Well, how do you plan for that? Well, when we were going to sell the company, we went to Goldman Sachs, and at the beginning they put together a presentation, as you do when you're selling a company and going out to multiple bidders. But they put together a presentation that was very me-heavy. I was like, why would anyone buy this if the business is so dependent on me? I said, put the presentation together as though I'm dead. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our Icon of the Year article on Tom Ford. It still has my name on it. Ford reaches inside the waist of his jeans and pulls out his underwear to show the Tom Ford waistband. But, wait, you've started wearing underwear? Yeah. Why? Well, especially with jeans, because these have rips, and any minute another rip is going to happen. Probably 10 years ago, and this is true, before I was wearing underwear, I looked down and an actual testicle was completely out. Let's talk about directing movies. As someone who's used to the pace of fashion and publishing, Hollywood seems scary slow. As a director, it takes 3 years to make a movie. I have maybe time for 5 more movies in my life, so they have to be meaningful. So you're working on a few different projects at various stages of development? One is an original, an extremely personal thing. A Single Man, 2009, and Nocturnal Animals, 2016, were both adaptations. This is completely from scratch? Completely from scratch. Then another is a book from Anne Rice. We started the process in 2004 while she was alive, obviously. And what is your writing process?
It's absolutely expository. I start every morning at 9 o'clock. I sit down and I work from 9 until 1. Even if I don't think I have anything to say, I type. The beauty, really, for me, of filmmaking is the writing. Because when you're writing it, it's perfect. Nobody fucks up. The clothes are perfect. Everyone's saying it exactly the way you want. It's absolutely clear. The hard part for me is shooting, because this didn't work, that didn't work. You've got to keep moving. You've got a schedule. Where are you with your spirituality? I had it for a little while, maybe about the same time I stopped drinking. It was one thing that compelled me to write A Single Man, because Christopher Isherwood was very spiritual in an Eastern way. I was reading the Tao Te Ching every night before I'd go to bed. I'd read one of those very potent sentences, and I was able to have it. If you go back to the Tao now, has it lost its potency? I need to try again. I'm very pragmatic. I can't actually comprehend the science, but the universe is so vast. Our planet is so insignificant. There was a film in the 1950s with Anne Francis that was so ahead of its time. The idea is maybe our purpose in evolution was to create an AI being that becomes a consciousness. It will be like God, where we have created it in our image, and it will hold every bit of all of us. Ultimately, we will be unnecessary. Maybe our purpose in evolution is to end biological life and to figure out how to create the next level of being, an electronic consciousness. What was the movie called? Forbidden Planet or Lost Planet? I don't know. Anyway, whatever. It's not that interesting. Turn that recorder off. Let's have dinner. And that concludes GQ's Icon of the Year article, the exit interview with Tom Ford. And now we're on to Tycoon of the Year. As Kim Kardashian prepared to launch her latest mega enterprise, Skims Men's, she spent a lot of time revisiting the memory of her father, the late Robert Kardashian. Here, Kim joins her mother and sisters to talk about his great style, his last days, and how 20 years after his death, he continues to shape her life and work. Hyperreal by Sean Manning. Kim Kardashian still remembers her father telling her about the time, not long after the O.J. Simpson trial, when he went to see a psychic. The trial had been a difficult period for Robert Kardashian, who hadn't practiced law in years. But back in the late 60s, he and Simpson had become close friends at the University of Southern California. And when, in June of 1994, the former football star was charged with the double murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, Robert agreed to join his legal defense team, mostly as a liaison between Simpson and his other lawyers. The trial thrust Robert and his family into the public eye for nearly a year, an exhausting level of scrutiny. Then he started receiving death threats. So one afternoon, he sought out a seer to find out what the fates had in store for his family. The meeting went against his nature. A devout Christian, he'd always heeded the Bible's warnings against psychics and mediums. But now here he was, listening to a prophecy that was so outlandish that it confirmed his suspicions. "She saw my last name and said Kardashian will be internationally known," Robert later told Kim. "This is how I know they're full of shit." Kim Kardashian recalls this as we sit on the couches at her Calabasas, California business headquarters, a contemplative space that feels more like an art gallery. She wears black lounge pants, a black hoodie, and a white tank, all by Skims, the label she co-founded in 2019. This isn't her first business. She's also launched 2 beauty lines, several perfumes, an energy drink, a mobile game, and a private equity fund. But this may be her biggest phenomenon yet, not counting, of course, her family's reality TV shows, which have aired 24 seasons to date. Known for its inclusive approach to sizes and hues, Skims was born out of Kim's frustration with dyeing her existing shapewear, a category then dominated by Spanx, in the bathtub with teabags to better match her skin tone and cutting off the legs to better suit her red carpet outfits. The brand has now expanded from shapewear to underwear, loungewear, socks, intimates, and swimwear, and plans to open its first physical store next year on LA's Sunset Boulevard. Currently valued at $4 billion, Skims soon stands to be worth even more, with its newly launched men's line in a partnership as the official underwear of the NBA. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Nick Bosa, and Neymar are the brand's official spokesmen. Kim believes men will benefit from the same confidence boost women get from Skims. Men have similar insecurities about their bodies as women, she says, whether they talk about them or not. Skims' men's range of offerings, including tanks, tees, and leggings, aligns the company more with a brand like Nike than with Spanx. Kim is the Michael Jordan of the influencer generation, says Skims co-founder Jeans Greed. Many 19-year-olds who never watched Jordan play and don't play basketball themselves wear Air Jordan sneakers every day. Maybe you don't watch the Kardashians every week, but you're a Skims customer. I just wanted men to find out what all the hype is about, says Kim. Her interest in menswear and clothing in general goes back to her father. This man had style, says his ex-wife and Kim's mother, Kris Jenner. When she and Robert started dating in the mid-70s, he wore almost exclusively Gucci, sports coats, pants, loafers. He and his brother Tommy were such loyal customers that the Beverly Hills store would call to let them know whenever the latest collection had arrived. The first gift Robert ever got me, says Kris, was a fancy Canon camera that I could never figure out how to use. The second gift he got me was a beautiful Gucci bag. I was a flight attendant at the time, and I was just so excited. As a child, Kim would often play in her father's closet with its precisely organized ties, belts, and suits. When I was 5 or 6, she says, I was climbing up a shelf and the shelf gave way. I just remember waking up in the hospital with a concussion. Robert evolved his wardrobe as the years passed. He always wanted to look cool, says Kim, recalling the time in her teens when she worked at the trendy Encino clothing store Body. Diesel was one of the brands we carried. They had a cool pair of jeans. They were wax-coated. My dad's office was really close by, so he'd always stop in. He said, I have to have those. I got them for him. He would wear them with just a black t-shirt and a loafer. Today, Kim likes to remember her father in head-to-toe Gucci, not the pajamas he was confined to at the end during the last weeks of his battle with esophageal cancer. Robert Kardashian remains a novel character in the family. He's the Kardashian that most of us never knew or never got to know in the context that we now know the others, but his influence has never abated, especially the influence he had on his middle daughter, who has been thinking about him a lot lately. This past September marked the 20th anniversary of his death. Kim remembers one particular conversation from his last days. I know you're going to be okay, Robert told her. It's almost like I can see ahead. I know you're going to be okay, but just take care of your siblings for me. Just make sure you take care of them. She still thinks about those words, just take care of your siblings for me. From then on, she considered her family and her ambitions in a new light. I took what he said to mean that I was going to be okay in life, she says, but it made me make decisions differently. Now 43, Kim Kardashian has lived nearly as much of her life without her father as with him. Today, he's mostly remembered as a friend and lawyer to O.J. Simpson, but Robert, like his daughter, was primarily an entrepreneur. One of his most lucrative ventures was Movie Tunes, a company that provided music for cinemas. The family lived in Beverly Hills. They had a pool and a tennis court. But Robert, the child of hardworking Armenian Americans, didn't believe in handouts. All three of his daughters worked at Movie Tunes in their teens. One of Kim's first jobs was writing the intro and outro copy for each song. My dad had me sign a contract for everything, Kim says. When I got a car, I needed to have it washed once a week, make sure that it had enough gas and that I didn't run it into the ground. It was a gift he gave me at 16, but I had responsibilities. While she was working at Body, Kim decided to start a clothing resale business on eBay. Robert allowed her to use his credit card for such purchases, but she had to quickly pay it off, plus interest. I'd work at my job and give him my paycheck, she says. Kim was making sure to pass on that same work ethic and business sense to her own children. Most weekends, her eldest daughter, North, will set up a lemonade stand at the end of their street. She gets a huge pitcher and fills it, puts it in her wagon, and goes down to the corner, says Kim. She has a table and chairs and fans to keep herself cool. She makes signs. She stays there hours and hours. Her friends help, so she splits the money with them. If a random person stops, she will charge them only $2. If she knows you, she will fully scam you. I'll get calls from my friends saying she charged them $20 for a lemonade. She'll grab their $20 and say, I don't have any change. I try to have my kids be as normal as possible and live in a neighborhood where they can ride bikes to their cousins' houses, Kim continues, not ignorant of the fact that that neighborhood is fortified with a gated entrance and guards who request identification to enter, in addition to the family's own personal security. I understand that it's not a normal life. We're never going to have a normal family life no matter what. As a parent, I want to protect them as much as I can. When I arrive at the Kardashian compound in Hidden Hills, a 22,000-square-foot mansion that she and her ex-husband, Kanye West, who now goes by Ye, spent much of their marriage and tens of millions of dollars renovating into a kind of modernist, minimalist temple, I find that North and her three siblings are in Italy with their father. Inside, in an immense suite that serves as a fitting salon and makeup room, Kim sits cross-legged in a chair before a wall-length mirror framed with vanity bulbs. She is barefoot, hair up in a twist, wearing black Skims leggings and a black Nike hoodie with the logo of Harvard Business School, where she was invited to speak earlier in the year. Kim has also been going back to school herself. For over 2 years, she's been working with legal tutors in the hopes of passing the California bar examination and getting her law license. Her commitment to criminal justice reform has already seen her help secure the commutation of several prisoners' sentences and the passage of the 2018 Bipartisan First Step Act, designed to reduce excessive sentences in the federal prison system and promote rehabilitation, among other initiatives. On the suite's vanity, next to a pink can of her Alani New Kimade energy drink, sits a silver-beaded MacBook, stacks of note cards, and two binders labeled Wills and Trusts and Professional Responsibility. With only an hour before her glam team arrives to get her ready for filming the show, here Kim sits diligently taking notes. On the laptop screen is one of her tutors, Chuck Schoenholtz in Nashville. "The Tenzing Norgay to her Sir Edmund Hillary," he says. "Chuck is the reference king," Kim says. As sincere as her commitment to reform is, Kim's prime motivation to become a lawyer is to honor her father, who was never shy about his aspirations that his children might follow his career path. When Kim told her mother about her plans to become a lawyer, Chris, with her usual terse humor, replied, "Of course you are. That's not weird that you're going to go to law school on top of the 50 million other things you have going on." Recalling this exchange, Chris adds, "But who doesn't need a good attorney, especially my family?" When I ask her sisters, Courtney and Chloe, if they would hire Kim as their lawyer, they both immediately say yes. "I ask her anything and everything, so she sort of is my lawyer," says Chloe. "I just don't pay her." Kim tries to study 2 or 3 hours each day and hopes to take the bar exam late next year or early 2025. When I ask Chuck what kind of student she is, Kim offers to excuse herself. I can use the restroom if you want. But it's clear enough from her exhaustive note-taking. Though she writes fast, in print, not cursive, the text is meticulous, a near-verbatim transcription of Chuck's instruction. Later on, she will transfer the notes from the paper to the note cards. In the 2 days I spend with her, as I ask invasive questions about her dead father, the only time I see her grow even remotely frustrated is when she can't find the same pen she previously used to take notes and must accept the clashing inks in despair. "Listen, I don't care if she's there or not," says Chuck. "No puffery, no hyperbole. That is one badass woman. She is smart, sharp. Dude, nothing but admiration for her. She works her ass off. Have you spent the day with her? Her schedule is ridiculous. It's like two people. You know what's the coolest thing, though? It's a sneaky smart, because what we do together is so 180 degrees from the public persona thing you see in the photographs and stuff. I wish more people could see through the glam." The first time Kim ever set foot in a courtroom was the Simpson trial. "My dad pulled Courtney and me out of school," Kim says. "He said, 'I want you girls to witness a piece of history and what a trial is like.' We walked in and saw my mom sitting on the other side. She said, 'You're supposed to be in school. What are you doing here?' Courtney and I didn't even look at her." Kris Jenner was close friends with Nicole Brown Simpson. Though Robert would later come to express his doubt about his friend's innocence, he loyally served as a member of the defense team that secured Simpson's not guilty verdict. "That was really tough for our family," Kim says, of the 15 months between arraignment and acquittal, during which her parents were on different sides of one of the most sensational trials in American history. "Courtney and I were drawn to our dad. We felt like Mom was happily remarried, so we would live with Dad. We didn't want him to be by himself." By then, it had been 3 years since Robert and Kris had divorced. Kris was 18 when she met Robert, who was 11 years older, and 22 when they married. After 4 children and her mid-30s, she found herself desperate for some independence and told Robert she wanted a separation. "He left for Palm Springs," she wrote in her memoir, returning 2 days later and telling Kris, "I decided I don't want a separation." Feeling trapped, she undertook an affair that lasted 3 months. Robert caught her on multiple occasions and finally had her served with divorce papers. Robert and Kris did their best to keep their troubles from their children. Courtney knew. "Just being the oldest, I would overhear things," she says. "I remember one night hearing them whisper arguing. My parents never fought my whole life, so it was traumatizing when they did." Kim, though, says she never heard any quarreling. "I didn't foresee any of it," she says. "I was in the bath, and they called a family meeting. I remember thinking, 'Please, Lord, don't let them be getting a divorce.' I never had an inkling that it would happen, but I knew that was what they were going to tell us. I felt it." Kim was 9, around the same age as North is now, when Kris and Robert divorced. "I did think about how my parents handled it with us. I just remember them being open." I ask how she handles any questions about her divorce her children might have. "Ultimately, what matters is that kids feel loved and heard," she says. "You want to be sensitive because they're just kids, and it's hard to go through no matter what age. You have to make sure that you only go to a level that they can understand. It's okay to show a vulnerable side. You never go to a negative side. But restraint does not mean absence of strain. Just because I know how to manage my stress well doesn't mean that I don't feel the emotions," Kim says. "If I'm sad, of course I will cry and feel it." As viewers of the reality show know, some Kardashians are more embracing of therapy than others. "I've definitely talked about it for years with my family because I really do find it so helpful," says Courtney, "but I also don't want to push it. You can give them the information, but then it's their journey." Sometimes she wishes she could go back to a previous version of herself. No feelings, bitchy Courtney was a vibe, and it was so nice not to give a fuck. I ask Kim if she's ever worked with a therapist. I tried a little bit before my marriage ended, she says. I do have a therapist that only deals in child psychology that I talk to get parenting tips and advice, and sometimes I feel challenged by parenting, but I have the best group of friends, and we talk about everything together, so that, to me, is therapy. I hit the lottery, the fucking mega ball of friends. Among these are a group of six women from Kim's childhood, including Allison Statter, that refer to themselves as the Lifers and wear personalized pendant necklaces that Kim had made for them. I knew Kim pre-Kim, says Statter. When I asked what she considers the line of demarcation, she thinks for a moment and then jokingly says, "We flew Southwest to my bachelorette in Vegas 15 years ago. Now that's definitely not happening. I would actually love to see that happen. I don't think there's a difference in who she is. I think that there's a difference in what her life is." When I ask Kim's sisters and Statter how she is different since her divorce from Ye, they all cite a renewed confidence. "Not that she wasn't confident before," says Chloe, "but it's a different assurance that she has in herself. She knows she can do it on her own. She knows the power that she has within herself, as opposed to thinking the power was in someone else's hands." "I know how scared she was to do it," says Statter, "because deep down inside she wanted her family to stay together, and because she was like, I don't know what life is going to be like on the other side of this. I was just so proud of her." In addition to her friends and family, Kim also turns to psychics and mediums for reassurance, despite her father's dismissal of them. There are a few that she consults regularly. One is more of a spiritual healer, putting out good vibes and energy, she says. "When they tell me things, I'll write them down. I don't walk away thinking that I'm going to read the list and make sure that everything comes true. After a few days, I'll forget about it, and then 6 months after the fact, I will reread my notes from the session, and it will have happened." Perhaps most of all, she relies on her Christian faith. "I'm probably more religious than most people guess," she says. She prays with her children every night before bed. If the kids are at a sleepover, they'll FaceTime with Kim to say their prayers. They also read Bible stories from the same books Robert read to Kim and her siblings when they were children. Courtney has the original books and shares them with the family. "That's how I manage life," says Kim. "I look at everything as lessons. Things happen exactly the way that they are supposed to and take you exactly where you need to be. Even if it doesn't make sense at the time, it leads you to a path." She references a meme where Jesus is pulling a small teddy bear away from a little girl, but behind his back holds a much larger one. She doesn't understand at the time, and she just wants her teddy bear. And that's so true in life. It was at Carousel, Robert's favorite Middle Eastern restaurant in Hollywood, that things started going wrong. One night, out at dinner with the kids, enjoying their kebabs and cabbage salad and cheese borig, Robert began coughing, choking. He excused himself and went outside. "Are you okay?" the kids asked when he returned to the table. "It's so weird," he said. "The food is getting stuck down my throat." The kids urged him to get it checked out. He did, and a procedure was scheduled. He made it seem like no big deal. Kim and Courtney went with him to the hospital. After the procedure, the doctor came to the waiting room. "Do you girls know that this is terminal?" he asked. Kim was about to turn 23. Courtney was 24. They just looked at each other. After the diagnosis, Robert didn't tell any of his friends. He wouldn't even tell his parents. Kim finally took it upon herself to do that. "I called them and they were like, 'What? What are you talking about? We'll be there in a few hours.'" They came up from Palm Springs, and he was in bed. Can you imagine? They were close, and to not tell them? My grandmother was never the same again. Chloe, who was 19, had no idea how bad it was until he stopped coming into the Movie Tunes office. My dad was someone who prided himself on never missing a day of school when he was a student. She says he prided himself on always showing up, even if he wasn't feeling well. She used to be so angry at him for not being more honest with her and her 16-year-old brother, Rob. Had they known, they would have put their teenage concerns aside and spent more time with him. But you get older and more empathetic and aware of life, Chloe says. I don't think he could admit it to himself. I think speaking it would have been like sealing his fate. And now, having kids, I could not imagine having to accept it myself. Courtney and Kim were at his house almost every day, rotating in shifts. About the only thing he could get down his throat was the cream of wheat that Kim would prepare with lots of butter and white sugar. The sugar went against the recommendations of the Chinese healer Robert had flown in, who advised him to eliminate anything processed and drink this weird green herbal concoction. When Robert first tried the drink, the disgusted look on his face made Kim burst out laughing, and they went right back to the cream of wheat, and soon he struggled to get even that down. Kim wanted to take some photos with him. When the kids were growing up, Robert often had a camcorder at hand, seeking to capture as many moments as possible. Kim now sought to do the same, hard as it was to see her father losing so much weight. "No pictures," he said. I don't want people to remember me skinny like this." And then one time toward the end, he said to her, "Get the camera. I want one picture of me now, so that when I get healthy again, I can look back." "That was the only time he got positive," says Kim. She doesn't know where the photo is now. Kim didn't hold onto that image of him sick and dying in her mind either. The figure he cuts, even in memory, is vivid and alive. When I asked the Kardashian women how Robert might have responded to the show had he lived to see it, they all say he would have been proud. Courtney, though, is a bit more deliberate in her response. "There are parts that are wonderful and amazing and I'm so grateful for," she says, "and parts that can be hard, like my fight with my sister, where it drags things on in an unrealistic way because of the nature of our show. We have to watch the edit and relive things then, and then relive it at the interview. My dad was very much into the closeness of our family, so I think that those moments would make him cringe." As Kim's allotted hour of law study reaches its end, there is a knock on the door. Her glam team enters, pulling roller suitcases full of supplies. They are here to transform her from aspiring lawyer to reality star. And once I've left the room, the Skims will come off and the makeup will go on. She will stop looking backward and do what Kim Kardashian has always done. She will get back to work. Oh, and we will get back to the GQ Men of the Year issue next week. We've run out of time here on Men's Magazines. I'm your host, Robert Streit. I've enjoyed reading for you, and I look forward to reading for you again next week. Between now and then, take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Peace.